Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner right here on The Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. On the way to break, our news break a minute ago, I made the mistake of saying 17 years. What I was thinking about when I said that was 17 years since the almost since the attack of 9/11 and 14 years since the beginning of the Iraq War. And so on this 14th anniversary, this era of the anniversary of the Iraq War, we're going to have a discussion where that war has taken us and how they're connected to some of the wars previous and where we are right now. The three gentlemen who are on this program were actually guests on the show during the lead up to the Iraq War in some of the serious debates and conversations we had during that time. And join us now. 14 years later, to kind of look at where we are, though all of them have been on the show since then as well. We're here with Dr. Tabet Abdullah, professor of Middle East history at York University in Toronto. His latest book is Dictatorship, Imperialism, and Chaos. Tabet, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be back.
And Dr. Stephen David is with us, professor in the Department of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University. And if I have this right, Stephen, your latest book was Catastrophic Consequences.
That's right.
And good to have you back with us, Stephen.
Good to be here.
And Dr. Adil Shamu is with us. He is Associate Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in D.C., Senior Policy Analyst for Foreign Policy and Focus, author of Equal Worth, When Humanity Will Have Peace. And Adil, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Mark.
And as we contemplate where we are and where this is taking us and where it may still take us, please join us at 410-319-8888. You can email us at talk@steinershow.org, tweet us at Mark Steiner, or you can log on to our Facebook pages. I do want to hear your thoughts, so please, 410-319-8888. So, you know, and I was thinking back to all the things you, as I was trying to remember what people said in the program back in that day, we need to kind of go by our tapes, and I'm really interested to hear our old tapes to see the debates we had leading up to this war between 2011 and 2013. And Stephen, let me just start with you just for a moment. I'm going to go around the room here, just a kind of retrospect. And I know that you back then, you had questions, but you were not completely unsupportive of the idea of the war in Iraq.
That's right.
Right. So talk a bit about where you've come to in these last 14 years.
Well, if I had known then what I know now, I would have been very much opposed to us getting in, not just because of the mess that was in the wake of the Iraq War, but of course the fact that there were no weapons of mass destruction. And to me, the main reason for going in was to prevent Saddam Hussein from using and developing weapons of mass destruction. And now we found out that he had no real viable programs. And again, if that intelligence had been known, I think I and many others would have opposed a war that we grudgingly supported.
And Tabet Abdullah, good to have you back with us again as well. And I know from the very beginning you had opposition to the war, though you've had these, confrontations, disagreements on the program about the aftermath of the war and what now responsibility is. But your reflections after these 14 years.
Well, yes, I mentioned, I think if I remember correctly, I was living in Syria at the time.
The first time we spoke together, you were living in Syria, correct?
That's right, that's right.
That's right.
And I had conflicting views about it. I was against the war because of the destruction that I felt was going to befall my country. And I also did not trust the intentions of the Americans. I didn't think that the announcements of state construction, you know, building democracy, massive investments, etc., were actually going to take place. But on the other hand, as one who has suffered under the Ba'athist fascism and the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein, a part of me was sort of happy that perhaps this nightmare was going to come to an end. Now, looking at it now, I'm still conflicted. I haven't really changed my views on this, except for one thing. I think that many of us in the opposition to Saddam underestimated the very, very deep wounds that that regime had created in the country. None of us, there is not a single Iraqi writer that predicted the level of social fragmentation that we didn't. So we all knew that this was going to be very difficult, that, you know, perhaps there was going to be another struggle to get rid of American influence and Iranian influence, etc. But the level of retribalization, of regionalism, of social fragmentation, none of us really understood it to that level. And to me, it's one of the biggest crimes of Saddam Hussein regime.
I want to explore some of the things you just said in depth, both of you, but let me turn now to Adil Shamu. Adil, again, you were, I remember when you first started coming to the show, it had to do with medical ethics, and then we leapt into foreign policy over the years. but again, you, if I remember correctly from our early conversations, you opposed this war from the very beginning.
Oh, yes, I did. Even though I have lived in this country for 52 years, I knew the Ba'athist. I don't know how well Thabit knew the Ba'athist, but I knew the Ba'athist very, very well. And I knew they will destroy the country in the process of governing, especially Saddam, who killed half of the Central Committee of his Ba'athist party. So he is a ruthless, and the Ba'athist was just a vehicle for him. And I opposed it for, I know American politics. The WMD, when I'm surprised one of our colleague, Stephen Davis, didn't know that it really had nothing to do with WMD. There was sufficient evidence prior to the war. And I remember I had about 50 people in my house in December 2002. And very active, some of them in politics, an anti-war movement, etc. And the discussion was the WMD has nothing to do with it. They want to invade Iraq. Remember the big sign of 1 million people in the streets of United States in Washington and hundreds, if not thousands, of demonstrations all across Europe? No blood for oil. That was really firm belief. And Dick Cheney's excuses and others that... that we're doing it for blood, you know, for oil. I mean, not for, sorry, for WMD. There were very little evidence for WMD. The intelligence agencies knew that. The prior station chief in Baghdad, the CIA station chief, wrote a book basically saying, we all knew the intelligence was sort of cooked. We gave them the evidence, but it wasn't the WMD. There are hints here and there, and they manufactured the rest of it. It was a political decision. And yes, the reason that we invaded Iraq was oil and making our friends safe, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the rest of them. And that's really why we went. And we destroyed. Here is a country in Iraq, and I'm from Iraq originally, a country for no absolute reason. We went to two wars, right? And however, for 9/11, and some of it was justifiable. However, Iraq, just imagine you are in Iraq, living in Iraq. Somebody killed at a minimum 300,000, wounded 1 million people. And then nobody hears about it in this country, as if it's okay, we can't kill that many. It's as you know, I have written just even as recently as a week ago on that issue about Trump wants to go back and take the oil. And that was the mentality then. And if you look, by the way, at the Chairman Joint Chief Staff, when he gives talks, the second or third bullet from what's called Chairman's Goals, okay, is maintenance of transportation of oil from Middle East to the West. What do you think that means? Like Chuck Hagel once said, do you think we went to that war for figs?
So let me turn back for a moment to Stephen David. I want to kind of parse all the things that we've just said here. But let me come back to the beginnings of the war for a moment. And talk about this. Because all three of you said something really very different. And Stephen David, first let me just start with you, kind of hear your response. I don't want to get stuck on this for the entire hour, but I do want to get back to that just for a moment. the question of what we did know and did not know about weapons of mass destruction. We saw the testimony by Colin Powell and others, but there was ample testimony as well by many who said it was bogus, that it never existed. So what about reflections on that moment again?
I mean, my sense is, and maybe I'm still somewhat naive, my sense is that senior policymakers believe that Saddam Hussein did have plans to develop weapons of mass destruction. There wasn't enough pushback in the intelligence agencies regarding the evidence, but there was ample evidence that he was developing these systems. After all, he incurred billions of dollars of sanctions. He interfered with inspectors. He certainly gave the impression he was developing weapons of mass destruction. That said, I wish our intelligence agencies had done a better job not engaged in groupthink to come to the conclusion they did. But the notion that somehow we knew he was not developing weapons of mass destruction and simply went into Iraq for the oil, I don't find persuasive. I mean, the kind of money and blood and treasure we spent in the Iraq war would never be repaid by what we could get from access to their oil. So I'm just not that cynical, and I just don't think that senior officials in the American government conspired to make up the weapons of mass destruction myth. But, to use as a justification for the war.
So I'll come back, but the oil
was not the only reason. I mentioned to make our friends and allies in the region safe. Steve should remember that there was this Bill Kristol headed top right wing conservative Republican and non-Republican asking Bill Clinton in 1999. To invade Iraq, there were books written by Ken. What is his name? The case for invading Iraq by one of the scholars used to be at the CIA prior to his becoming a writer. I'm sorry.
Pollock, I think.
Pollock, yeah. Ken Pollock's book.
Yes.
The case for invasion of Iraq.
Yes.
I mean, he wrote a whole book, and he's so. There was a whole movement of pro-Israelis and right-wing Republicans to invade Iraq.
Yeah, but I mean, Israel's biggest enemy at the time was not Iraq, but was Iran. So,
the notion that somehow America invaded Iraq to serve Israeli interests, again,
I think there's very little.
But the path to peace.
So, I mean, I don't want to get stuck on this for the entire the entire program.
Path to peace was, we were told, goes through Baghdad. That was the answer of Bill Kristol and his cohorts. Let's not forget that.
So let me pick some other pieces apart here, because I think that it does raise questions about who do we trust in what they say about what leads us into different conflagrations and battles and wars, and I want to come back to that. But I'm going to pick up on something for a second that some people may look as a sidebar, but I think is central to who we are as human beings, and it's something you said, Tobit, when you said you didn't expect to see inside of Iraq the social fragmentation and the deep wounds that grew out of Saddam. And I was thinking about people we had on the show early on, and one of the things I'll never forget was conversations with people who had come in the last 10 years from Baghdad. And one couple in particular who I still know to this day, he was a veteran of the Iran-Iraq war. He was Shia. She was a student in Baghdad, and she was Sunni. And one of the things that was clear talking to people was that a majority of the marriages inside of Baghdad, I'm talking not the entire country, but Baghdad, were mixed marriages in the sense of between Sunni and Shia.
That's correct.
Right?
That's right.
And B, if you look at Sarajevo, the marriages between Christians and Muslims was the same kind of dynamic,
that,
right?
Yeah.
So, Tobit, explore that for a moment. Since you raised it, let me let you explore it first. What does that mean? What does it say about us, about humanity, that this world of this cosmopolitan world gets destroyed that way? And how you think about it now?
Well, that's a very heavy way to put it. You know, what does it say about humanity? I don't know. What I can say is, I think it's important not to over exaggerate this.
What do you mean?
It's not true that the majority of marriages were mixed in Baghdad. That's not correct. But certainly, there were many of these kind of marriages, and especially evident among the middle class in the urban areas. And the middle class in Iraq was growing very rapidly. By 1980 or so, it had reached perhaps about 30% of the population, we could say, was middle class. And it was rapidly growing, becoming a wealthier third world country. What has happened is on many levels, really. First of all, the terror and the repression itself causes incredible suspicion of anybody, and the people you begin to resort to are individuals who are closest to you, your family, the people you see in the places that you worship, the tribal links, etc. These things that were on the decline, the terror itself of the authoritarian regime tends to bring back up. Secondly, the physical destruction of the country. First, the 8 years of war, then the American bombardment, then the sanctions, then the second American bombardment, and ultimately the decapitation of the state after the American occupation. All of this left no institutions that were functioning. So again, you resort to the small, tight-knit groups that bind humans anywhere. And, you know, I've said this many times when you've had me on before, Mark. I believe that any country, let alone a third world country, and, you know, Iraq, yes, it had many things going for it, but even in its heydays in the 1970s, it was still a third world country. But any country, even the most advanced industrial countries, even the ones with the strongest sense of national unity and national consciousness, they would be hard-pressed to come out of 8 years. Actually, one shouldn't say 8 years. Since 1980, Iraq has been at war, and it has been a very brutal war. And bombardments, and the worst sanctions ever in put on a country in history. All of this is bound to have a toll. What I said in my opening remarks is that the terror of Saddam's regime, I think many of us underestimated it. So that when the Americans went in, many of us thought that the sense of social unity is still strong enough to be able to carry the country through its difficulties. But what has effectively happened is that the middle class in Iraq has been eradicated. I mean, either physically removed or killed, or turned back into impoverishment. So that this group that was the most enlightened, the most progressive, has been replaced now with groups that value sectarianism as the most important glue that binds them together. And I think this would befall any country, including the advanced countries.
So any thoughts from either one of you to follow up on what Taba just said?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I would just say I agree with much of what he said. I think especially when a country has its government either weakened or removed, the default option for people is to identify with their ethnic group. And even those in Iraq who maybe didn't consider themselves a Sunni or Shia, intermarried, whatever, if the government isn't there to protect you and you feel that the only protection and only security you can get is from your ethnic brethren, then you're going to identify with your ethnic group even if you hadn't done so previously. We've seen this in Iraq. We've seen this in Rwanda. We saw this in the Balkans. And to a certain extent, we've seen it in the United States at times of domestic upheaval. I mean, it's harsh to say in the 21st century that ethnic identity is so important. But even when it's latent, again, if government is dissolved, you turn to the people you trust, and that's often people of your ethnicity.
I fully agree with Steve on this one. People have a default position, and it's safety by proximity of some characteristic within them. Throughout the history, that is the case, and Iraq was no different, really, and especially with the regime of Saddam, and the way he was removed, it just decapitated the entire government and military force completely from existence, and Iraq still, its military force is intentionally kept weak. For example, the Americans never gave him airplanes, never. How could you have a country, have no wonder ISIS appeared. They never gave him an air force whatsoever. They're supposed to have rebuilt him so he could fight ISIS. Guess what? Today, he has no airplanes.
That question of rebuilding Iraq in that sense, I think, is a huge question to wrestle with. So let me, were you about to say something, Stephen?
No, go ahead.
So I'm curious about the consequences of this war in terms of where we what we think about a policy and what how we address the world. I mean, let's just start with this: that if you look at the war years before that in Afghanistan, when the United States was still kind of obsessed with fighting the Soviet Union. And we sent in and supported these Arab militias to go into Afghanistan and other Muslim militias to go into Afghanistan, gave rise to the birth of Al-Qaeda. We've seen the war in Iraq disrupt the entire country, have that bleed into Syria. It's more complex than that, but bleed into Syria. What we call ISIS at various times. Our IS and the Islamic State. So the complete disruption of societies, you know, just like when complete disruption of anybody's society can lead to crime and violence, we're seeing that same thing happen on a larger global scale. So, I mean, what does that teach us about what we have to think about in terms of the world and what our response should be? I think America doesn't know what its response should be. I think we haven't known for a long time, which is why we resort to things like what we did in Afghanistan and what we did in a greater way inside of Iraq. Tabit?
Well, I think I thought when I was a student in the United States, the sense I got, Mark, was that your generation that was traumatized by the Vietnam War had come to the realization that as powerful and as wealthy and as desirable as the United States is, there is very, very serious limitations to its powers and what it can do. And, you know, as a historian, I can tell you that the most amazing imperial states that have appeared in history always have a smart beginning and a dumb end. There's a sense toward the end that there is an omnipotence to their power, that they can do anything with military force and economic investment. I'm amazed that the United States resorted to this once again in Iraq. You know, this issue of the weapons of mass destruction, so well, again, I don't want to reopen it, but I think even the most diehard supporters of the invasion should really see that it could not have been only for weapons of mass destruction. If that was the case, there are so many other countries that have weapons of mass destruction. There were many other considerations, strategic location, the importance of controlling the oil market, if not petroleum itself, the question of protecting allies, as Adel mentioned. But to do so directly and to think that, you know, one can get away with it with impunity, I thought that the United States had learned that this was impossible since the Vietnam War, and yet it was repeated in an even more tragic way. We are far from over and seeing the consequences of this. I think there are still many, many twists and turns to come in the Middle East. Right now, the signs are still not good at all. I mean, I'm very happy with what is going on in Mosul. There is a sense of an Iraqi army that is emerging, though I agree with Adid that the United States has placed very clear ceiling on how advanced any kind of training or certainly equipment is to be applied. Even the Kurds, the staunchest allies of the United States in the region, complain endlessly. I mean, I'm in constant contact with people there. They complain endlessly that the American military refuses to give them the advanced weaponry they need to actually take on even ISIS. So I think there's still many twists and turns to this. I think it would behoove Americans to once again look directly at the very clear truth that there's a limitation to American power. You cannot go into a region and reinvent it or do some kind of massive social engineering project and create states out of nothing. This does not mean that the United States should stay out of the region, though. I think especially toward the end of the Obama administration, and I hope the Trump administration would continue this, though I'm not hopeful of anything to do with Trump, that the Obama administration took a new sort of refreshing, a rejuvenation in terms of its policies in Iraq. They appointed a good ambassador. The United States has been very active diplomatically in trying to get financial assistance to Iraq. They've played a positive role in trying to bring especially Sunnis and Shias together and also the Kurdish contending parties. So the United States should focus on this kind of activities rather than military adventures.
So we have to, Stephen, why don't you jump right in? We have to take a short break, an ID break, and come right back. We'll come back to Stephen David and Dr. Adil Shamu as well as we look at the Iraq War 14 years later, 410-319-8888. Stay with us. Join us with your ideas and comments. Welcome back, folks. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show and your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm here as we look at 14 years later of the beginning of the Iraq War. You just heard Dr. Tabat Abdullah, professor of Middle East history at York University in Toronto. We're also here with Dr. Adil Shamu, associate fellow of the Institute for Policy Studies in D.C., senior analyst with Foreign Policy and Focus, and Dr. Stephen David, professor in the Department of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University. Before we hit the phones here, Stephen, you were about to say something, it sounded like.
Well, yes. I think you were asking what are some of the lessons of these interventions that have gone awry. And I think one of the lessons is the potent force of nationalism. I mean, in some sense, it's easy to intervene, and it's not even all that difficult to remove a government, as the United States did in Afghanistan, as we did in Iraq. But then you've got a mess, and you've got to be prepared to either sort out that mess or ask very hard questions before you start the process in the first place. It's not as if America can't go into a society and impose democracy and have it stick. I mean, we did it in Japan and Germany after World War II. But that required a major war and an occupation which in some sense exists 75 years later. If we're not prepared to pay that price, then maybe you don't go in the first place. And it seems that both Obama and Trump are very wary of putting large numbers of boots on the ground. And my guess is this is a lesson learned. But I worry that it's learned too much. Maybe we'll get into this, but, you know, 500,000 innocent people have been killed in Syria, and we just shrug our shoulders and look away. There has been talk about no-fly zones, safe areas, places where Syrian refugees can go. But it's not clear whether we or anyone else is willing to pay that price. And I, for one, find that morally diminishing that we're allowing this atrocity to continue doing virtually nothing to stop it.
So I'm going to come to that, because another question that kind of ties it into it, but Adil, let me let you jump in here before my next thought.
Well, I think that policy of invasion, we've just refined it. We did that all over again in 2011. We did it in hijacking the Arab Spring. Arab Spring was a revolution. And revolution in about six Arab countries, and they were all hijacked, with the except of Tunisia. Well, because Tunisia is a barren country, they have nothing. Libya was toppled. Then Syria, the biggest example is Syria. We actually now we do it with the special ops. We send 500 or 5,000 special ops, and we use the Saudi money, especially in Syria, billions, literally billions and billions of dollars, and we create hundreds of small groups to fight the government of Syria. Syrian government, sooner or later, would have been toppled by the natives, and unfortunately, they lost control, and each group had a benefactor giving them the money. And that's why you have the civil war. Nobody want to talk about it here in this country again, but with the Middle East is a common knowledge. But if you read the New York Times, you read some sort of more detailed scholarly book, you see that the Syrian revolution, which was true revolution in the first, if you remember, it was a true revolution in the first 12 months. And then got hijacked by having so many groups. Each thinks they represent the country. It's unfortunate, and the same thing with Libya. It was none of our business going there and killing Gaddafi. Why is it our business, even when Saddam had WMD, why is it our job to go and kill him and hell with what happened to the people? There is just philosophically very bad thing. No wonder we have a lot of enemies. The very first reaction I had, and I won't say, somebody called me up quarter to nine, the day of the 9/11, and I said, honey, we have made enemies, unfortunately, and some of these enemies are very extremist radicals, and they'll do anything against us.
So let me talk about two aspects of where we are right now, pardon me, in this world, in the aftermath of this war. And I'm going to come back to the question of Syria and in a moment. But so I think that it does seem to me, though, that we are in a huge quandary about what our response should be. I mean, so out of these wars, now you can don't have to put all the blame on the shoulders of the United States, but a good portion of it, I think, does belong on the shoulders of our policy of the West, which is the birth of Al-Qaeda and the birth of ISIS. That came out of these two conflicts the United States got us involved in, Afghanistan and Iraq. We don't know how to put the pieces back together.
You know what? The best thing could happen to the Middle East. The best thing could happen, get the hell out of us out of there. Even though I like our position now in helping the Iraqi to get rid of ISIS from Mosul and Raqqa, I have to admit, out of desperation because of what the countries, the local population cannot do with themselves. But in general, we should stay out of it and stay interfering with these. Instead of armies now, we use a special ops and drones. We have mechanized the military invasion into sort of more technological invasions.
But where does that leave us is what I'm trying to figure out. I mean, and I think nobody knows where it leaves us, because that's why I think, Stephen David, people cannot figure out what to do about Syria, about what the response should be, because we have destroyed Iraq. It's still in the midst of war and battle. And the U.S. cannot leave because it has to help deal with ISIS. The situation in Afghanistan is very tenuous. Libya is anarchic.
And after Syria,
we threw out Gaddafi, right?
And Syria is destroyed.
And Syria is a basket case as a country at the moment. So Stephen David, we'll go to Tabit.
Well, Mark, first of all, I think you have to give some agency, some responsibility to the people on the ground. I mean, one of the reasons that Iraq dissolved the way it did was that you had Shiite governments that allowed no power, no autonomy for the Sunni population. I mean, if Maliki had been a more responsible leader and had a truly inclusive government, Presumably, Iraq would have been stronger, would have been able to resist ISIS's encroachments, and it would have been a very different outcome. I'm not saying America bears no responsibility for what happened. Of course we do. But the notion that all the bad things happened because America intervened or was got involved, I think, is also misleading. Look, a lot of bad things happened with the Arab Spring, and certainly in Syria, with very little direct involvement of the United States. I mean, the Middle East is a mess. And I agree that we don't want any large-scale interventions there. It's likely to make things worse as better. But that doesn't mean that we should turn a blind eye to developments there as well. I mean, where we can do good at little cost in blood and treasure, we have to think creatively of how to do that. And again, I think no-fly zones and safe areas, despite the complications they provoke, require some another look, a look that the Obama administration, I think, was very quick to dismiss.
Talbot?
I tend to agree with Stephen Davis on this. I'm not hesitant to condemn the United States, and I've written, you know, before the American invasion, even as there was talk about it, that one thing that the Americans should keep in mind is that they're not really trusted in the region. It's not just the Americans that caused this. It's primarily, in fact, I would say it's primarily the fault of the different groups within the region itself. But I think that the point that was raised, especially about Syria, that Stephen Davis raised about Syria, is one that has had me thinking quite a bit. And I agree that here, you know, there was no 8-year war with Iran. There were no sanctions. There was a very brutal regime, but even there, the Iraqi regime was probably more authoritarian. But now, despite the fact that it did not face these kind of structural destruction, Syria did fragment. So the causes, you know, to what is happening, you know, sometimes appear much deeper. I think if we think about, you know, what the United States should do or shouldn't do, it's become clear time and time again since the mid 20th century, really, that all-out invasions, unless as Stephen Davis says, there's this will to invest as heavily as America did after World War II. Unless that happens, then this should be avoided at all costs. What America should do is to take on a more internationalist approach to these issues. I'm not in favor of America washing its hands of it, but if America is to be involved, there should be a lot of effort placed on going in with other powers just to mitigate some of the decisions, you know, that these things would be given a broader platform. If an attempt had been made early on to assist some aspects of the Syrian movement, this should have been done as an international effort. And I think the United States can be very persuasive and quite effective if it really puts an effort into building such coalitions for intervention.
I'm going to get a couple of calls in here that have just called in, but let me let you do a quick follow-up.
Well, I think if you look at the history of Iraq and Middle East, the Ottoman Empire was defeated, and the new colonization of Brits/American came into existence. The Brits basically vanished after Second World War, the Empire, and then the American replaced them. So it's colonized one way or the other, either directly or indirectly. And when they misbehave,
they actually use either covert operations or open invasion to maintain the same benefit. I mean, the comparison to Second World War, Japan and Europe, even afterwards, it's totally different story. That was two countries advanced, and militarily they invaded us basically in Pearl Harbor, etc. And there was a common agreement that to basically Germany we have to help them. The Marshall Plan. There is no such thing anymore. And I'm delighted. America has done good, but since 48 till now, all the good we have done has been thrown out with military interventions, either directly or indirectly. I'm puzzled by the fact that neither of your two guests realize how much covert operations and drone operations we have here. We are killing in Yemen alone, 10,000 people have been killed in this low-level civil war. 10,000, and Yemen is poorer than anybody in the world almost, and we have a naval ship blockade on them. How could you tell me this is humanitarian? How could you tell me this is for the advancement of the Yemeni people? We are supporting Saudi-controlled thugs in Yemen. So that's really our policy. It's a continuation of the colonization which started after Second World War, unfortunately, and it needs to change. It needs to change. I mean, I wish America was as good as it did with Japan and Germany after Second World War.
Let me open the phones here, 410-319-8888. Your thoughts for our three guests, Dr. Otto Shamu, Dr. Stephen David, Dr. Tabit Abdullah, as we look at this 14th anniversary of the beginning of the war in Iraq. And Michael, you're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Michael.
From the way I see it, from Desert Storm, Bush at that time, the father, knew that to take Saddam out of that region would destabilize the whole region. They knew it at that time. They also knew at that time that they had no weapons of mass destruction, or they would have went in at that time. I sit back and I watch how Saddam controlled that area. There was no Taliban, there was no ISIS, no formations of any of that, because he controlled that area. He wasn't the best ruler, but he controlled that area. And I think they made a big mistake when they went in and lied about it. And I think that's another reason why Colin Powell resigned, because, you know, he couldn't keep up with that lie. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Quick thoughts on what Michael was saying?
I have a
Tabit Abdullah
on something. No, because there was no question, so I'm not sure. But I have a comment about that.
Go ahead.
Everybody knew when Iraq invaded Kuwait and the United States went in, everybody knew that Iraq had, in fact, weapons of mass destruction. I mean, they had used it in the Iran-Iraq war. In fact, Saddam Hussein, in a televised interview, boasted about it. He said, you know, so what? We do have chemical weapons, and I'm even willing to use them on Israel if necessary. So that's not correct that they hid that or whatever. I think the main reason that the United States did not remove Saddam Hussein from power then was because of the fear of that the instability might cause, especially to the Gulf countries. There was a real fear in Kuwait and among the Saudis that removing Saddam might unleash some kind of a Shiite wave in the region. And it took a very long time before the decision to remove Saddam was actually carried out.
Any other quick thoughts on that before we hit the phones again? 410-319-8888. Dave, you're on the air. Welcome.
You know, I disagree that there were chemical weapons of mass destruction. There was a Marine officer who was involved in going inspection of Iraq, and he denied that there were anything of the sort, including a former ambassador. Tony Blair, when the 9/11 happened, said there was a failed state in Afghanistan and he needed to replace the conditions that led to a failed state, and still is valid. And the consequences of not eradicating a failed state are still with us today. There was an article in the Washington Post yesterday talking about Afghans coming back from Pakistan and just living on dirt, terrible conditions. I also want to mention veterans who experienced Vietnam, and there was a Jacob George who fought in Fallujah, and when we went back into Fallujah, he took his life. There are like 20 vets that are taking their lives daily or something of that nature, 10 to 20. Consequences of war really live on, and we got to think about that if we launch any kind of military attack in these areas. Thank you.
Dave, thanks so much. And I think, you know, that's something that when you look at where we are today in the wake of all this, that we are in a place where we have disrupted, I think, in our wars, a number of societies throughout the Muslim world. That we have, we're in a place where we are in a quandary about how to respond to anything in the world at the moment, without other than using military force. We're in a situation, Taba, that you've talked about many times in this program, which is even if you oppose the war in Iraq, we've now dismembered a country, and America now has a responsibility to help put that back together. What does that mean? And how do we do that? And it also puts us in this place now where we see Trump with these bans on people coming from around the world who are Muslim into the United States. And then you did the additional problem continuing with Israel now that has a very right-wing government intent on making both the West Bank and West Bank especially one part of Israel. So, I mean, this is not – we're in a really, I think, much worse situation in that sense than we were 14 years ago.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. But, you know, we are keeping, you see, we are affected by these wars. But the effect on us is really not, you're talking about 500,000 dead and 1 million wounded. We had about 4,000 or 5,000 dead and 40,000 wounded. But we don't count the 1 million mental health issues. We don't count them. This is our country. We need truly freedom of the press to go into the record and show those data, rather than having media basically some of them that just mouth the news of the State Department.
And if I could just jump in here, I don't think the real danger is that we're going to, you know, intervene massively in this country and that country. I think we've learned our lesson. My concern is that maybe we've learned it too well, and we'll move from an interventionist foreign policy into one that is totally isolationist. And certainly when you listen to Trump and his rhetoric of America First, which of course was very much of an isolationist movement in the 30s and 40s, there is a sense that America shouldn't do anything anywhere for anyone. And so I'm worried that we're going to overlearn the lessons of Iraq and Vietnam. And that will condemn us to deal with even bigger problems down the road.
I wasn't advocating what you said, but anyway, I'm saying is we are doing all these things for our interest, not the interest of these countries. And the effect on us is really small. And Trump and his people, Bannon and others, have taken advantage of that and basically emphasized the nationalistic view of how to deal with these things. Leave them alone. Let them kill each other. That's you're right. That is the danger. But I personally do not want us to involve with military force with 200,000 troops or substitute them with drones and special ops. I mean, let's face it. The special ops and drone have increased dramatically in the past 10 years.
So,
can I...
Talbot, please. I was about to ask you to jump in. Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. I think... first, I want to say something about the issue of American veterans. One of the sites that has stuck with me so much when I went back to Iraq in 2004, and there were still battles going on. I mean, I actually witnessed a battle in the desert as we were driving by. The Marines were still engaged with some Iraqi forces. But one of the most really remarkable sights is not the numerous Iraqi families that have had horrible tragedies. For some, in a very strange way, they are able to deal with it as a collective catastrophe that's befallen everybody. But the ones that appear to be the most disturbed were these young 18-year-old kids, many of them from Oklahoma and Arkansas and so forth, that were standing around guarding, you know, some installation or something. And until now, I can tell you, Mark, I have never seen the sight of fear more than on those young kids, much more than on the faces of Iraqis that have suffered even more. The wounds that are left on the American soldiers are very real, and it's very important for us to you know, while we go around condemning American actions here or talking about American military adventures there, not to forget that these young kids are bringing much of this violence back.
Thabit, you don't know what I have written and done in this aspect. I consider them heroes because they are complying with the democracy's decision for policy. Even under these conditions, and many of them do not agree with it, they go and get killed or wounded for the rest of their life. They're disabled and do this. So I'm very much with them, and I have interviewed, as Mark may know, with our side discussions sometimes, I have interviewed and seen hundreds of disabled veterans,
20
years old, at Walter Reed.
The thing that is so stark in my mind is the, because I went there with the predisposition that I am there to sympathize, you know, with my own countrymen. These are the people who have been brutalized, etc. And I can tell you that it was the American soldiers that I sensed were, in a very strange way, suffering even more. Now, obviously, they did not suffer the same kind of physical destruction, but psychologically, Iraqis were actually dealing with the numerous catastrophes much better than the American soldiers.
And gentlemen, on that note, this has been a really fascinating discussion. We've covered a lot of ground. I want to thank the three of you so much for your time here today on the Mark Steiner Show. Dr. Thabit Abdullah, Professor of Middle East History at York University in Toronto. Dr. Adil Shamu, Associate Fellow of the Institute for Policy Studies. And Dr. Stephen David, Professor in the Department of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University, who joined us 14 years ago and now join us again to see where this has taken us. Thank the three of you so much for your thoughts and being part of the show today.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening in and being part of the show today as well. As always, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ Baltimore. No, sorry, we did that already. Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by the Maryland State Education Association. From limiting overtesting to protecting public school funding, you can learn more about the issues facing Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. Or SteinerShow.org is Maryland State Education Association's website. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producer is Mark Gunnery. Our producer is Imani Spence. Our research producer is Calvin Perry. Our production assistant is Nadia Ramlagan. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our intern is Morgan State senior Michael Dixon. Our theme music is by Warren Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. And to podcast the Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.